This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 41 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. As I always tell you guys, those help out a bunch. I think we're at 73 reviews right now on iTunes. Obviously, 75 is a short-term goal, and then 100 will be nice, you know, coming up. So appreciate those. You know, if you want to throw me one of those, that'd be great. Thank you, as always. Another huge thank you. I mentioned this on the previous episode 40, that we'd be hitting 20,000 total downloads for the show by the time that episode kind of cleared through. We did hit that. I think we're at like 20.1 now. So that's amazing. You know, I can't thank you guys enough for all the support, you know, in terms of just the downloads, the plays, the sharing, you know, and also just really cool to see the amount of feedback, that this is getting. I always think it's a cool thing, you know, when people, voluntarily like message me or, you know, send me feedback on the show. Could be coaches. I actually get a lot from coaches, you know, in the industry, peers that actually listen. Today's guest actually, surprisingly enough to me, and I say surprisingly just because, like, you know, he's a big time, you know, name and coach in the industry, and just hearing that, you know, he listens to the show, you know, and that's kind of how we got, you know, started talking about getting him on himself. The fact that he listens and, you know, really finds the content, you know, useful, and he likes what I'm doing with it, it just means a lot, because, you know, coming from someone like that, I know I'm doing something right. So stuff like that's been awesome. And, you know, even the, you know, athletes and parents and coaches from like around the country, around the world, you know, it's just been amazing to see the growth and some of the feedback. I'm going to pull this up right now. I want to say, so let's see, the last 10 episodes here. I'm on my podcast hosting site. So the last 10 episodes have been listened to in over 973 different cities and 42 different countries, which is just incredible. I don't know where these people find the show. I guess Twitter and Instagram, whatever. But it's really remarkable to see the growth like that. It's really important. It means a lot to me to be able to have an impact like that, because that was my main goal when I started this. You know, obviously, in addition to getting, you know, useful content and information out to people, you know, coming from me and some of the, you know, coaching connections I've made as well. So that's been amazing. Shout out to the previous two episodes, episode 39 with Emily Walden. If you're looking for, you know, some insight on what goes into evaluating players at the minor league level and prospects coming up, you know, to the big leagues, and some of Emily's stories in terms of getting in the industry and some of the players she's covered and kind of what her job involves for The Athletic and Baseball America, check that out for sure. She was great. Last week's episode, episode 40 with Kevin Poppy, download wise is, you know, going to do 500 within the first 6 days, probably based on the pace that it's at right now, which is just amazing and just says a lot about the quality of the episode. Kevin and I talked for like almost 90 minutes or over 90 minutes, and it felt like it was 10 minutes because we just flowed in a lot of stuff and, you know, a lot of great stuff was covered. So shout out to Kev. That was an amazing episode this past week that just dropped, episode 40. If you haven't listened to that, definitely check it out. Kind of hitting something real quick before I get into a little bit of background on this week's guest. So on Twitter, if anyone saw this past week, there was a lot of debate on the drop step versus the crossover step. If you follow me, you saw, you know, I got into it a little bit with Dallas Braden. Obviously, tremendous amount of respect for Dallas as a former big leaguer, guy that brings a lot to the table in terms of growing the game on social media and the coverage he does, whether it's on his Twitter, with his Starting Nine podcast, you know, hosted by Barstool with Jared Karabas. I love what they do with that. He basically posted something, you know, about the drop step with the Ronald Acuna stolen base attempt against the Cardinals late last week, and basically saying that the drop step made him slower, and everyone knows I'm passionate about that and the teaching of it, and, you know, how it's, you know, one of the best reactive ways to, you know, get out of a lateral, you know, start to get your position where it's supposed to be and all that kind of stuff. So I made a post and kind of shared some guys that have done it in the past and with success, you know, the Billy Hamiltons, Ricky Hendersons, D. Gordons, Mike Trouts, Byron Buxtons, those guys, like, you know, those elite base runners and elite speed guys that they've done it. You know, it turned a little, it was a little contentious at first, but then it turned into a really good conversation. You know, obviously I have great respect for him in terms of, you know, his wealth of knowledge of baseball and particularly, you know, pitching. You know, but I just wanted to kind of defend the running style because that is what I do, is I teach people how to sprint. So, you know, it kind of went into more of a learning, you know, type of interaction where he was kind of curious as to why it was better or why it was optimal or why it was done in the first place. Obviously, some people do prefer a loaded front side crossover step. I prefer the drop step for obvious reasons I've detailed. You can make arguments for both. I think it depends on the situation. You know, but in a reactive sense, it's definitely the best type of start you can have. Basically, we started going back and forth about that. I DM'd him. We had a, you know, great conversation privately. And it's kind of turned into the fact that after the postseason's over, I'm going to have Dallas and, Pitching Ninja on an episode together. So I'm really excited for that. So I just wanted to announce that to you guys. Super thrilled about that. Be on the lookout in November sometime for that episode. It's going to be amazing. So upcoming schedule for the show, episode 41 with Zach Dakin today, obviously, episode 42 with Alan Bishop, episode 43 will be with Joe Arattari, episode 44 is going to be with Blaine Kinsley, strength coach at Arkansas for Arkansas baseball. And then episode, I'm losing track of my numbers here. I think it's episode 45. Hold on. I'm going to double check that for reference for everybody. Yeah. Episode, 45 will be with, and I don't want to mess up his name, so I'm going to give him his at name, that guy, Kai, Kainoa, I believe it would say, based on how it looks, Correa, he's the, defensive coordinator for the Indians, just a really, really smart guy that brings a lot to the table with defense and, you know, athletic movement and things of that nature, and also how he got into the field. So really, really great, you know, lineup of guests coming up. And then obviously in November, we're going to have that Dallas Braden and Pitching Ninja episode. So a lot of good stuff coming up. You know, shout out to the people that got involved in that conversation. Austin Wasserman shared a study, comparing the two. Joseph Potts got involved a little bit. Guys I have a lot of respect for in the industry that, you know, are very knowledgeable. So it was great to hear their perspectives. Bob Alejo got involved a little bit. He was, you know, with the Oakland A's for years and actually, you know, I believe from what I've seen, I did think did some work with Ricky. He obviously knows Dallas very well. And, it was just really cool to see a lot of coaches kind of get involved in the conversation. That's like the most important thing is, you know, we're all trying to push the game forward. So, really happy the way that turned out. You know, kind of end my rambling here. Today's episode, like I said, Zach Dakin, a little, background on Zach. If you don't know, Zach is just a really, you know, smart, brilliant guy, you know, with what he does with the baseball team over at TCU. And, I believe he works with the football, quarterbacks as well. So, you know, really excited to have him on. He got his start. He was a senior. He's actually been the senior assistant director of strength conditioning at TCU since 2008. As I mentioned, and as I said, he oversees baseball as well as quarterback development for football programming. Before TCU, Zach spent two seasons with the LA Angels and 2 years at Missouri State University. And he's creator of the work and series Movement Over Maxes, talking a lot about, you know, the importance of creating quality movement, working movement patterns, in terms of overall, you know, movement development, you know, and kind of parlaying that into strength and speed and kind of working on them all together, which is kind of the inspiration for today's episode, and the title being Synergy Between Quality Movement, Strength and Speed. So without further ado, welcome on Zach. You're going to love, you know, what we talked about and kind of what he brings to the conversation and what he does with his athletes and, you know, some of the stuff that goes into the Movement Over Maxes series and, all that kind of stuff. So I hope you guys enjoy. Zach was amazing and, you know, excited for what we have coming up even beyond this episode. As always, hit me with any feedback, questions, comments, whatever you have. And obviously if you have a guest, you want to recommend or any questions you want to be used for the topic of a future episode, let me know. As always, I will see you guys next week. Peace. All right, everyone. I'd like to welcome Zach Dakin onto the show. Zach, thanks so much for your time, man. I'm really excited to have you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Love what you're doing and, excited to get this episode taped.
Yeah, for sure. One of the first things I kind of wanted to start with, you know, given it's something, you know, big that you've done, and I love the work, obviously, is your Movement Over Maxes. First things first, kind of wanted to let you just like maybe give the listeners a little bit of a background on, you know, what inspired you, to kind of go into that and to do that. And, we'll kind of go from there and like what it involves and you know, what it's all about.
Sure. Yeah. Movement Over Maxes is our foundation program for our developmental athletes. So it's all of our incoming athletes. They go into this program, and it was put in place just to teach basic fundamental movement. So many athletes lack the basics when they come into a program like ours. You know, we noticed that the kids didn't know how to hip hinge. They don't know how to get in a basic athletic position with their, you know, with their spine flat, their shoulders pulled back, utilizing their hips again. They don't understand these basic fundamental concepts. And so that was where this program grew in the last 15 years. And then I really wanted to put it out there for the baseball coaches that wear every hat for their program that have to, you know, that they're coaching the hitters, the pitchers, they're doing the strength and conditioning work. I get emails constantly on what should I do with these high school kids? What should I do with, you know, I'm a small college coach. What should I do with my kids here? And so really that's how the program turned into a book. Was I wanted to help coaches like that didn't have access to a strength coach.
Yeah, for sure. That's one, that's awesome. And two, like, you know, if anyone listening, I kind of go through the same thing sometimes. Like you mentioned, you know, getting coaches to reach out to you and like ask you questions. And it's amazing how many coaches, you know, like you said, wear different hats for their program. Like they do everything. And some of them, like there's a lot of coaches out there that are really just trying to get the right information and make sure that if they're running, you know, the strength conditioning for their team, they're doing the right stuff. But like you said, like it's pretty crazy too. Like, you know, no matter the level, sometimes like even college athletes, like sometimes don't have that simple ability of like a hinge, like you said, which is so important for baseball, in any sport really, but like we see it a lot in baseball. Obviously we'll talk about that, but, it's pretty cool that, you know, that kind of materials out there for coaches now to kind of get a hold of and make sure that they're hammering the basics. Cause like you said, if there's no foundation there, you know, it's kind of hard to kind of go anywhere else from there. Right.
Right. I mean, the foundation sets up everything in the future for us in our program. And if you can't, like we talked about, if you can't hip hinge, how can we advance you into velocity based training or even beyond that, if you don't know how to control your body in the basic fundamental patterns?
Yeah, absolutely. You see, like, so many athletes want to rush into things. And, I mean, it's tough. The internet is like a place where you see a lot of, you know, especially Twitter now, you see a lot of advanced, training going on, you know, with some high level coaches, but to have to take a step back and understand, like, hey, it takes, you know, some time to get to that. And you're not seeing the whole picture. Like, things were done to lead up to that. And, you know, getting a little bit into the movement pattern type stuff, like your basic fundamental movement patterns, like mastery of those was, you know, accomplished before we got into things like VBT and, you know, stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. The internet, social media is excellent for a lot of things, but at the same time, it can be just as bad for, wanting athletes to jump over too many, you know, too many basics. They want to advance way too fast. And I'll give you an example. I've got, you know, I train pro baseball guys in the off season as well. We'll have a group of about 25 to 35 pro baseball guys that come back. And some of them aren't TCU athletes. I had a major league pitcher last year. The first time I had trained him, I asked him, you know, if he'd ever done an RDL or a hip hinge or anything like that. He didn't even know what it meant. He said, I've never done RDL before in my life. And I said, you've never been taught a hip hinge before? And he said, no, I don't know what a hip hinge is.
Yeah.
So this is what we're doing. I mean, this guy made it to the pinnacle of his sport without ever even knowing what a basic hip hinge is, which is incredible in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty incredible. One, to the fact that he made it there. I mean, not to say that it's mutually exclusive. Like, you know, learning a hip hinge is like step one before you're on your way to the big leagues. But like,
exactly.
But as any list, like all my list, a lot of my listeners are strength coaches. Like, I'm sure a lot of them would understand this. Like, that is a main movement pattern and just main, you know, pillar of movement. It's just incredible to see someone get to that level without being able, like, you watch any baseball player, like, I'll give it, guys, this is a really easy one, but Mike Trout, like, when you watch him hit, like, every position he gets into at some point in the batter's box, at some point of his swing, like, there's a beautifully executed hinge right in there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it speaks to the fact that, yeah, the weight room doesn't transform you into a major league baseball player, but at the same time, a basic hip hinge is a fundamental movement pattern of life, not just baseball or athletics. It's a fundamental movement pattern of life and protecting your spine. And so, Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was incredible and it was very eye-opening. And really, Movement Over Maxes, I wanted it to reach the bottom levels, right? Because that's where we need to make the most change. It's how many of us strength coaches really ever get to work with an elite athlete? Like, for instance, yeah. Mike Trout, how many of us really ever get to affect an elite of the elite? Really, where we need to make change is down at those bottom levels with our youth and our high school kids. That's where we need the best coaches, the best information going so that they can develop those guys so that they get to those elite levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like no better thing to like to see, you know, I see it all the time with your page, like people tweet, you know, videos to you like, hey, random high school team could be anywhere in the country, the world. And, you know, maybe they pick something up from your work or your book or, you know, something you've done and they're applying it to, you know, their practice or their training. It's just great to see that like so many coaches are one, open-minded, and two, you know, now have access to, like we said, you know, the internet and social media is a beautiful thing, mostly because of the fact that it gives you access to things that, you know, years ago you would have never been able to kind of get your hands on.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So you brought up a good point. You know, not only sports, but obviously, we're mostly talking about sports here, but, you know, basic human movement is, you know, based on these movement patterns. You have your squat, your hinge, you know, your push and your pull. So we can get into, you know, there's obviously your vertical and horizontal, both of those, but we'll keep it to just the push and pull right now for simplicity. And then you have your unilateral variation. So your split squats, your lunges, things like that. You know, how much general human movement is based on these patterns? Like I tell my general population clients all the time, like, you know, yes, you want to come and train and, you know, everyone wants to burn fat and, you know, lose weight and everything. But, you know, I want to help you get out of the car a little bit easier and get off the couch, you know, with a little less effort and bend down and, you know, pick up your luggage the right way when you're at the airport, like stuff like that. So right. Kind of just speaks to your point tremendously. Talking about, you know, zeroing in on, let's say, the hinge in baseball and, you know, a lot of talk about, you know, hitting and pitching and the importance of getting into the hip and, you know, being able to use that and ride it out as a power source. You know, give us a little breakdown on that in terms of, you know, teaching it and, you know, its importance in baseball.
Well, sure. Let's, you know, the big five movement patterns you just touched on really in their essence are a program. That's what it was designed as. You look at the squat and the hinge. Those are the two basic lower body movements that you do with everything, whether it's a trap bar deadlift, whether it's a front squat, you know, an RDL pattern, a glute ham raise. It involves those movements. And then the push pull on the upper side, whether it's vertical or horizontal, you've trained both sides of the upper body. And then the, you know, spinal stability stuff with our ISO core series that also includes, you know, an ISO lunge for the single leg. Those are just, it's a program in its entirety right there. That's if you just took the big five patterns. But the most important one to us for athletic development is the hinge, right? The posterior chain is everything when it comes to athletics. Kids want to be we call it mirror muscles, right? They want to build everything on the front, what they see in the mirror, the chest, the abs, the pecs, or the chest, the abs, the biceps. They want to build those mirror muscles. But performance lies on the backside. And so that's why the hinge to us is so important, because it's performance muscles. We've got to learn and understand to separate the pelvis from the spine. That's everything in life is based around that. And then when we start talking about pitching and hitting, we want athletes. We have to have athletes to be able to sit back on that hip and be able to hinge, to be able to ride that leg down the mound. We see so many athletes want to turn into a quad dominant pattern and push out of that position. And to be honest, it completely throws off the biomechanical efficiency of rotation for the pelvis, puts athletes in a bad position. And most of the times what you find with these guys is that it's been coached into them, right? We coach it into them to push down the mound, to push with that back leg, to jump off the rubber. When that's just not how the body works or how rotation truly works. And so a lot of times we take a good pattern and make it worse by poor cues or poor coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember growing up, you know, looking all over the internet for things like, you know, as a pitcher to try to throw harder and improve my velocity. And I remember seeing, I think it was talk about, it might have been Sandy Koufax or Tom Seaver. I think it was Tom Seaver, you know, quote unquote, pushing the rubber to second base. And it got me in some bad habits for sure. Obviously, as I became a strength coach and, you know, learned more about movement and, you know, seeing how important it was to, you know, not get on your quad. Like I was doing the exact opposite as a young pitcher. So you're right, spot on with that. Like it's amazing how that kind of gets, you know, broken down and, you know, applied incorrectly just through some cues alone.
Right. And you know, like Eugene Bleeker at 108 Performance says, there's no bad cue. It's just how the athlete perceives it. So we shouldn't say it's bad coaching all the time. A lot of times, you know, you might be trying to instill a cue that you understand and you understand how it works, but the athlete doesn't perceive it that way. And so it's not necessarily a bad cue. It's just how the athlete perceives it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because if you look at it, you know, pushing the rubber back to second base, a lot of people talk about, you know, accelerative movements, right? Like how much of the force applications through like that big toe and top half of the foot. I mean, you want the opposite almost when you're pitching or hitting. Like you don't want to leave your heel and push everything off the front of your foot to put it on your quad. So like you said, great point there. Like, you know, is it a bad cue or is it maybe some misunderstood or, you know, kind of thinking of things, you know, with the wrong concept, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, it's on a daily basis. We have to kind of individualize our cueing to our athletes really is what's going on here. Right now with our program, we're working on a ton of motor control with the pelvis, right? Especially with our foundation guys or our developmental guys in the foundation program. It's a ton of pelvic motor control. And what I find with those guys is every one of them takes a different cue. So I've got different cues for every one of those guys as we go down the line of how to get more efficient rotation out of their pelvis. So yeah, it's kind of finding what works for each individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to drive this point home for the listener, like you're talking about, you know, the developmental program, like we said before about the major league guy that came to you and didn't even know what an RDL was. Like, people have to understand, like, even college athletes, like, there are some that really need to drive home those, you know, fundamentals and the foundation of everything. Like, I think the misconception is that people look at actual age versus training age, right? Like, there's a difference in terms of what the athlete needs in their training.
Exactly. And really, Movement Over Max is the foundation program is put in place so that if you are a great athlete and you move really, really well, guess what? You can advance through it relatively quickly. We will advance you as fast as your development, you know, can take you. But if you don't have those basic patterns put in place yet, we're going to make sure that they're honestly grooved into your body, that you can do them without fail at any time. So we want those things to be stable before we move on. Really is the key with Movement Over Maxes.
For sure. You mentioned, you know, making sure guys aren't just, you know, I mean, everyone, the natural athlete wants to train those mirror muscles, like you said. I had a great conversation with, you know, a parent of an athlete that I work with the other day about like the importance of movement patterns. And, basically I was asking them what they had done for his training leading up to, our work together. And they mentioned like, oh, we did chest this day and back this day. And I thought of you right away because, just like that. I wouldn't say, like I said, you know, not misconception because it is a one way that training has been done over the years, but maybe more so along the lines of like why it's better to train the movement patterns. Thinking back to something you said once, I believe it was on Twitter about when you train the movement patterns, those muscles are still being trained, like not vice versa. Like when you isolate the muscles necessarily, those movement patterns aren't being trained.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, for us, I'll even give you a little recruiting speech. You know, we tell a lot of the kids that come in here as recruits, we work on a 3-day program through most of the year, a high-low program where we can put all of our nervous system energy into one day, essentially, right, and then recover the next day. But the reason we train total body from head to toe on those high-intensity days is because you don't get to separate your body into upper and lower or muscles over at the baseball field, right? You don't get to play on Saturday with your lower body, I'm going to save my upper body.
Yeah, your nervous system doesn't work that way.
Right, yeah, and then I'll just play with my upper body on Sunday. It doesn't work like that. The nervous system drives everything, and so we're going to make sure that we're training the athlete to be specific to the sport, honestly, for lack of a better phrase. So there are times, yes, there's times in the summer that we might take an athlete that needs to gain weight. We might put him on a 4-day program where we do a lot of upper lower or something like that and start separating muscle groups a little bit here and there. But it is honestly, it's fairly rare. We're going to train the neuromuscular system first and foremost. And to do that, we're going to train it as an entire unit for the most part, right? We need inter and intramuscular coordination. Those are concepts, big concepts for athletics. We need those muscle groups to coordinate movement within each other. It's not just locking a muscle into a plane on a machine and training the muscle itself. The body has to coordinate movement.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned again, like the 3-day week and, a couple points just to kind of emphasize for the listener, like one, you know, like Zach said, you know, you're not going to be able to split your body into like, oh, I'm going to just, let's just say for argument's sake, we're talking, power development. Like, you know, you did sprints, and some jumps on Monday and you're going to look and say, okay, well, on Wednesday, I'm going to do, you know, some explosive pressing work or like it. Your body is going to be taxed, you know, altogether, and your nervous system is going to be taxed altogether as one. It's not like you can just make separate transactions on it, so to speak. So, you know, working through movement patterns, like you said, is a really good way to be able to do all those in one, to kind of hit those in one day and be able to give yourself recovery from that day to the next.
Right. Yeah. We want to let the body, restore generally for nervous system, or the CNS, to restore the CNS after a high intensity day, which for us is speed, power, strength based. You're looking at a 48-hour recovery time. So that day after, we do low intensity work to try to kind of get the guys feeling good again, to get back to the, a peak for that next high intensity day. And a lot of times you don't want to force recovery on some of those low intensity days. We want the body to honestly to have to fight itself a little bit to recover. We don't want to supply artificial means all the time to force these guys to get back their CNS 48 hours later. We want that body to have to honestly restore itself a little bit.
So by that, you'd be saying that maybe like pushing it more towards like movement, like the difference between having a guy sit down on the table with a Normatec on. And I mean, we can talk to her blue in the face about like how that's just not all there is to recovery, obviously, but more so like pushing them to recover through movement, so to speak, and, you know, doing certain things to kind of get the body into the mode that we're looking to get it into, type of stuff like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got the artificial means that you just talked about, right? The Normatec and stim units and all this. And then you've got, you know, regular means like movement and activation, soft tissue work to push lymph around. Those are all recovery means, but there's a time and a place. There's a reason for not doing any of that stuff during your training, so that you force the body to adapt and accommodate. The Soviets used to talk about this a lot. They would have long periods in the off season where they wouldn't let guys do anything on off days. They didn't do anything for recovery. They didn't want the guys to try to restore their body faster, because you adapted to those recovery means. And so everything's a stress, right? Doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're in the cold tub, the hot tub, if you're doing cryo chambers, everything is a stress on your body. So they actually didn't want any of those stressors on off days. They wanted the body to have to repair itself, to learn to have to repair itself. And then in times of need, during competition and very important periods of time, they would start using those recovery means to accelerate the body's ability to recover for those high intensity sessions. So yeah, there's a time and a place for no recovery at all.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. One more thing I wanted to hammer on too, just not to reiterate things too much. I kind of have a habit of like sitting on things too much sometimes, but you brought up another great point before. If you have those movement patterns and you like think about it this way, and I know personally speaking, like when I first started out as a coach, that was like one of the first things I kind of, developed or learned was, you know, building a program. You know, if you're looking at a full body template, most of the time you're hitting those main movement patterns and that's your template, so to speak. You know, for the listeners out there, like, I always kind of say, like, that's a really good way to start. Like, if you know, like you said before, if you're hitting those patterns, you're getting all the muscle work you want to be done in those movement patterns. So, like, that's a really good place to start. Like you mentioned, like, being a program in and of itself.
Right. Yeah. When we're training movements, you have to understand these are large compound movements. So we're training, you know, entire muscle chains throughout the entire body, right? Yep. It's not just, you know, the front squat is not a quad dominant. It's only for the quads. No. It trains every muscle essentially from your head to your feet. The RDL, everything from the back of your head to the back of your heels, right?
It's like a sliding scale, so to speak. Like it works maybe something more than the other, but it all works everything.
Sure, exactly. But exactly, it works everything. And so programming movements, we're going to train all those things. We don't have to worry about the biceps if we're doing our pulling work, if we're doing heavy pulling work in a vertical or a horizontal plane. I'm not worried about the biceps because the biceps are getting great stimulation from that. The same thing, you know, triceps, pushing movements. We're including those because a pushing movement includes triceps, large compound movements. And truth be told, it's better for your body anyway, right? Because we're stimulating, again, coordination. We're stimulating the neuromuscular system to coordinate all those movements. There's too much good from it to not train movements and worry about isolating muscles.
Absolutely. And I want to, you know, even put this out there for, you know, those listeners I have that are, you know, your workout warrior, like average gym goer, like you can honestly, and I've done this personally in my own training, you know, with less time, is I've done supersets of, you know, push-ups with, you know, an ice eccentric and an inverted row, and my biceps and triceps are lit up afterwards. Like, great point on that end. Like, even if you're a regular goer, general population person, like, it works the same way.
Exactly. And honestly, you know, you can look at research and those big compound movements are creating massive dumps of growth hormone and testosterone at the same time. So a lot of times guys that step away from isolated stuff, you know, worrying about the muscles individually and having a shoulder day and a bicep day and a tricep day, they step away from those and start doing massive compound movements like trap bar deadlift and bench press and Bulgarian split squats all in one day. They actually start growing again because they're getting massive dumps of growth hormone, testosterone. Their androgen system goes crazy because that's what you get when you start training that many muscle fibers in one session.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at, you know, the movement patterns and maybe how you would take an athlete and progress them through, you know, let's say an athlete who didn't have any type of proficiency or strength or motor control in, let's say, let's use a push-up here for an example, right? You know, walk us through maybe a little bit of how you would use an eccentrics and isometrics to, like, improve that general range of motion and the motor control, and then maybe, like, progressing with some load and, you know, furthering intensity.
Yeah, for us, you know, if we started with the push-up, the book, I talk about regressions and progressions. So it depends on where the athlete is a little bit. If they're a, you know, if they're a weaker athlete, if they struggle, we're going to regress them so that they can complete the pattern with efficiency instead of just cheating the pattern, right? Which we use a hand pickup pushup for our, you know, one of our fundamental patterns. The hand pickup pushup makes athletes go all the way down to the ground. They have to get full range of motion. They pick their hands up, put them back down, and drive back up into that movement. With the push-up, we don't use a whole lot of eccentrics and isometrics in that early phase. Again, it just depends on where we're at with the athlete. So if it's a weaker athlete, you know, we regress them. If it's a stronger athlete, we'll progress them pretty quickly to using weight on their back, like a chain, a plate. But the one thing we want to make sure is we're not trying to rush development. We want to use the least expensive mean that will produce adaptation, right? We don't want to waste the body's ability to adapt on these extremely advanced methods and means, right? So we take it as slow as necessary. We're not going to rush into anything, right? So with a push-up, we usually start at 5 reps for our guys in the positions block. So we have 3 blocks as I ramble on about this stuff: positions, patterning, and performance. We start in the positions block, just learning the position. So it's learning the push-up position, and we put time parameters on it. So it might be a 10-minute time window where we do as many sets of 5 as we can, just grooving that movement over and over and over. As we move into the patterning block, it's a high-low format like we talked about a little earlier, and we start to add reps. We start to add reps into that. And we do that push-up with baseball athletes, we don't do it every day, but with the other patterns, we'll do those patterns every day in a high-low format. So one day is a high-intensity day, one day is a low-intensity day. And then as we advance out of that into our performance block, then we actually start to load the pattern. So with the push-up again, we would start loading it, whether it's chain, whether it's a backpack, what we call a backpack, throwing a band through a plate. The athletes can wear that on the back, and we start to advance reps and intensity, so volume and intensity in that performance block.
Yeah, it's just really, it's interesting, you know, so many people get caught up in just kind of, you know, ripping the intensity right away. And like you mentioned, like you're not saving any adaptation. Like if we can get someone to reach a point we need to get them to in the like the easiest way possible, like, you know, maybe not the best way to phrase it, but looking at like, hey, if I can get a guy from point A to point B using, you know, a less complex means, it's going to save that, you know, more complex mean later on. Kind of like you said before, you know, Joe DeFranco is a guy that I followed a lot coming up to the industry, and he has a analogy. It's like, you don't want to take a, or you don't need to take a machine gun out to, you know, kill a mosquito, right? Like, right. You know, maybe save that, for later on if you have something that requires it and it'll actually be more effective.
Right. Exactly. I mean, one of my favorite quotes is by Thomas Kurz, who wrote Science of Sport Training. And he says, training is efficient if the highest sport result is achieved with the least expense of time and energy. And I retweet that all the time. It's my favorite quote in all of athletics, right? The least expensive mean that we can produce adaptation with is what we want to utilize with these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's maybe, you know, give a little idea in terms of, you know, what you look for to see. I mean, obviously, it, from our perspective, it's pretty easy just on like what we've been trained to see with our eyes when an athlete comes in, and maybe we assess them or put them through just some general movement in terms of like, oh, like they can, you know, achieve I'll give an example. Like if I have a young athlete come in and, they're, you know, not the fastest and they want to get faster, obviously. And then I kind of get a baseline of, you know, what their strength levels are, and they're just really, really low. Like I can achieve a lot of, you know, improvements in their speed just from, you know, force alone, but maybe it wouldn't be the best served to have them doing advanced plyometrics right away when they can just get a lot of, you know, improvement from the force production or, improving their strength first and save those more advanced means for later on, so they don't, like you said, the adaptation too soon, and it makes them less useful later on. Is that like a good way to think about like what you're thinking?
Yeah, that's absolutely perfect. You know, I can't remember who said it. One of the Soviet coaches. It might have been Bondarchuk, but he essentially says you waste a method twice, right? So like depth jumps is a great example. Depth jumps, you know, for the Soviets were one of the most powerful training means you could ever have for the stretch shortening cycle, for producing explosive strength, reactive strength. Depth jumps were that. So he said you essentially waste a method twice. If you use this with a young athlete, when they're not prepared to adapt to it, it's way too advanced for them at that time. You essentially waste it then, and then you've wasted the opportunity in the future because they've already done it. Their body's already done it and tried to adapt to it. You waste it in the future when they actually need it to produce a higher result or attain a higher result.
Yep.
You've wasted it twice now. So that's what we do when we advance adaptation or try to advance means way too fast.
Yeah, for my baseball listeners out there, think of it like showing your curveball through the first time in the order when you're facing a team and you don't, maybe, you know, they haven't even seen your fastball yet and you can get through with that. You're kind of like lessening the impact it has, you know, if you were to break it out second or third time if they haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. I'll even add on to that with guys wanting to do velocity development with, yep, you know, with weighted balls, this and that. We want to make sure that your biomechanics are sufficient first, right? We want to make sure the arm pattern looks great. And that you move well before you go try to add weighted balls to a program. If you move poorly, adding load to that is not the answer, right? We can't put the frosting before the cake, and that's what too many athletes want to do these days.
Yeah, and you're almost compounding the the poor movement, right? I like to think of the nervous system as like poured concrete. Like the younger an athlete is, you know, you can move, if you just put concrete out, you can kind of, you know, move it around a little bit and mold it to where you need it to be. But if it has time to harden and you keep on like allowing it to stay in the positions that it's in and don't correct it, eventually you have to just take your jackhammer out and break the whole thing up and kind of start over again.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
So that, like, I try to tell the kids that, like, to make them understand, like, hey, this is why we're, you know, I know it's a little monotonous, but like, this is why we're spending so much time making sure that everything is, you know, kind of in check before we go put load on it, like you said, or, you know, we're going to be moving into arm care, you know, a discussion on arm care. So it's a great segue, like, you know, getting, you know, so focused on building velocity when the movement patterns and the biomechanics aren't where they need to be. You're just, you know, adding double stress one and, you know, you're going to add double the work because you have to go back and kind of like retool everything.
Right. Yeah. You have to re-clean up those patterns. I mean, if you let movement falter as you have progressed in intensity, all you're going to have to do is go back down the mountain and start over, because it's going to continue to break down as you add intensity. And that's really the entire basis of movement over maxes, is that you add intensity gradually as their movement is capable. Right. Yeah. Because if you keep throwing on weight, adding intensity and worrying about the weight and not the movement itself, the movement's going to break down. And then you essentially need to go back over and you have to go start over again.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about this, obviously, as, you know, a guy that works with a lot of baseball players, and I work with a lot of them as well. It's an important topic. And I actually was inspired, especially by a tweet that you had put out. I think it was like last week or maybe the week before, about arm care and some of the misconceptions that it's, you know, more than just, you know, hitting your J bands and taking care of your rotator cuff and, you know, doing your throwing. Like, it's obviously an entire full body venture, so to speak. A lot of the stuff, obviously, we talked about already with the movement patterns. You know, in your experience, what have you seen a lot with, you know, even some of the college age guys in terms of like the misconceptions they have about what it really takes to take care of their arm?
Well, yeah, I mean, so many athletes come to us and think that arm care, honestly, it's parents too. Arm care is a sheet, you know, a sheet of paper or a list of 10 exercises. And you're like, that's not arm care. It's everything, right? It's holistic. It's your entire program. It's the way you handle your body from the minute you wake up until the minute you go to bed. And even in between those, right? It's movement patterns. How do you move? How do you move in the weight room? How do you move outside of the weight room? It's the workloads. How much are you throwing? It's your on ramping, right? Your build up phase in your throwing program. Are you doing that appropriate? Are you adding intensity and volume as you go? It's recovery. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but that's, you know, multifactorial. It's your nutrition, your sleep. It's your stress levels, your biomechanical efficiency in your actual skill, right? How do you move when you're on the mound? What's your mechanics actually look like? So it's everything. It is not just a set of exercises. It's really not. We talk about it, you know, and I hate to harp on this point, but in the foundation program, Movement Over Max is teaching athletes how to correctly move in their upper body movements. That's so underutilized. It's not so much – it's not always what you do, but how you do it, right? And we want to make sure in those upper body movement patterns that guys are moving scaps correctly. So that's one of the biggest weaknesses we see, is athletes a lot of times pin their scaps down and just hold them in one place while they're doing their scap work. A reverse pull-up or an underhand grip row or whatever you want to call it. You know, guys don't know how to efficiently move their scaps around the rib cage. They don't know how to release the scaps at the bottom and then pull the scaps back into retraction or into upward rotation, whatever exercise that we're doing.
I see it with landmines all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not what you're doing, it's how you're doing it. Making sure that the scap is moving efficiently when you're doing your exercises, right? We need to teach those movement patterns. So there's so many factors that go into arm care. It's crazy.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, too, like, again, it goes back to the same kind of what we talked about earlier. Like, if you hit the movement patterns, you're hitting the muscle, so to speak. If you hit all of the facets of a, you know, good quality, you know, movement-based training program, you're taking care of your arm the entire time. Just because, like, you don't conceptualize it as like, oh, there's like this one time a day where I go do my quote unquote arm care stuff. Like, no, it's happening, you know, universally throughout your training week if you're doing the right things.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we want athletes to understand, that it's not just, you know, I'm going to do my J-bands every day before I throw. I'm not going to lift. I'm not going to worry about anything else. And my arm care is good. That's not arm care, right? Arm care is total body care.
Yep. Yeah. I want to say it was DJ Edwards said that on the episode. I had him and Bill Miller on it. I actually used it as like a quote for a snippet I did on the episode. Like he put it like that. He was like, arm care is total body care. And it's kind of, I think it was a really great way to, it resonated a lot with all the listeners, like who maybe hadn't thought of it that way before. It's like, you know, like you said, if I'm doing all the things right with my entire body, then, you know, I'm going to be in the right place. Something else I wanted to kind of hit on when it comes to taking care of the arm and the importance for throwers. And, it's something I've actually seen. I don't know why, but lately talked about, and maybe, you know, people trying to lessen the importance of it, you know, anti-rotational training and, you know, building that quality, so to speak. And you had another great tweet on that, of course, saying like, you couldn't understand possibly how that would be something that like you didn't want to implement into your training. Like, in terms of importance to the rotational athlete itself, talk a little bit about that. Like, you know, maybe what you're doing with your guys and girls, whoever you're training with, you know, anti-rotational work and how it, you know, has such an importance to throwing athletes.
Yeah, it seems like it's a kind of a fad lately. Anti-rotational movements. I don't understand it, because to me, all the anti-rotational movement is it's an isometric for rotational movements, right? And isometrics are huge right now across social media. Everybody's talking about isometrics, and that's all an anti-rotational movement is. So we love anti-rotational movements because, honestly, we can create tension. We can get guys to feel positions, right? We can groove where they need to be. We can set their pelvis through some of these motions and try to groove a little bit of motor control and work, honestly, on gluteal motor control. But I love anti-rotational movements, and we do a ton of it during the periods where we're swinging and throwing a ton, right? So fall ball right now, we do a lot more anti-rotation than we do rotation during this period, because they're rotating 400 times over at the field right now, right? So we take out a lot of the med ball throws that we might do in other periods of time to kind of save our rotation and drain more in an isometric fashion. That's really all it is. To me, it's just isometrics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like to tell, you know, people, the way I kind of conceptualize the whole idea is, you know, to be able to rotate effectively, you have to be able to quote unquote resist rotation effectively, right? Like, I like to use the analogy of, you know, a mattress, and I use this for jumping as well. If you have, an old mattress and the springs are very loose, you know, on that mattress, so to speak, and think of the, you know, the springs almost as like, elasticity in the sense of jumping. And, you know, in terms of, rotation, think of it as like the ability to resist rotation. If you jump on the mattress with the loose springs, you're going to kind of like sink into it and not get much, feedback, so to speak, into the movement, you know, the counter movement off of the mattress, versus a new mattress with, you know, rigid, elastic, you know, tight springs and strong springs, you're going to barely jump on it. It's going to shoot you up to the ceiling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're full of great analogy.
I'm an analogy guy. It was how I was in school growing up. So forgive me if I'm hitting you with like 40 of them, but, and I also love them for the young kids I work with in terms of teaching them how to, you know, learn concepts and stuff. I think it's great.
I just don't see what everybody else is talking about, because it's training the exact same muscles that we rotate with, just in a static fashion, right? We do that in everything else. We do it with overcoming and yielding isometrics, whether it's in a, you know, a split stance or a trap bar deadlift or for PAP or any of these other concepts we're using these things for. It's the same thing. It's just, we're not moving with it. It's an isometric. And there's plenty of studies out there that show the stronger you are in an isometric, in an anti-rotational movement, the stronger that you create rotation, right? So,
That's a beautiful point. I actually wanted to, the great segue. I wanted to kind of touch on this and shed some light on it. You mentioned, you know, if you're stronger anti-rotationally in an isometric, you're a better rotator. Thinking of it like in a really, like, you can't dispute the laws of motion, like they are what they are, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? So I like to explain it as, you know, if your core, if you have a strong anti-rotational ability that you've trained, it's going to basically, you know, force your body to put more into rotation to kind of, trying to think of a good way to explain this. Like, think about it this way. The stronger you are anti-rotationally, the more force it's going to take to put into rotation to begin it, right? Because you're opposing it more and you're better at resisting rotation. It's going to force you to put more, you know, into input in to begin that rotation. And as we know, what goes into movement comes out of it. So I like to look at it as, like, right off the bat, like, it's ridiculous to not, you know, understand the importance of it, because, or understate it at least, because it literally, you know, can enhance your rotational power ability just by that alone.
Right. Yeah. We're using the same exact, you know, lines of tension, the same fascial lines, the same muscles, everything's the same. It's just, we're not moving.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing, honestly, too, that I wanted to kind of run by you is, like, this was said to me about it one time. I had a very, you know, insightful conversation with the coach, you know, through DMs, and what didn't turn into like this big, debate, but, basically their point was that, oh, when we're open in space as, you know, throwers or hitters, like, we don't really have something to, just for an example, you do a regular Pavlov press, right? Both of your feet generally are anchored into the ground. His argument was that while you're, you know, swinging or throwing, you know, you don't have both legs anchored. And I said, well, at some point you're going to have to, like, the release of power at some point is going to happen with both feet, connected to the ground. Think about a pitcher, like, when that lead leg blocks and that goes to make contact with the ground, you know, both feet are in contact and you're still holding counter rotation. You're not going to be able to hold counter rotation with a weak oar.
Right. I mean, he needs to have a conversation with Eugene Bleeker and see where that goes when he's talking about anchoring feet into the ground. Yeah, we have to have anchor points, or there's nothing to produce force. There's nothing to resist force from occurring. So, you know, when a hitter hits, he doesn't swing with one leg up in the air. He anchors that front leg down in the ground and then rotates around that front side hip, right?
Yep.
And that's actually one of our monster points right now that we're teaching with motor control with our guys, with the pelvis in a rotational aspect, is anchoring those feet into the ground and not letting them, you know, pick up and sway, anchoring those feet into the ground and creating rotation through the hips with just the pelvis. So that's one of our biggest points right now, is to anchor both feet into the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, at some point that is going to occur. It has to. You know, and I like the thought, like, you know, visually speaking, you see all these pitchers, you know, holding counter rotation when their front foot strikes, like, that's to me is the epitome of the importance of anti-rotational training right there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just another tool in the toolbox, and
exactly.
We can't throw it out. Simple as that.
Absolutely. So I like to, we talked about the main movement patterns. I always like to say, like, this isn't technically one, but I like to sometimes add, you know, core training itself as, like, the sixth. It's almost like, the Oxford comma, like, I'm adding it. But, you know, kind of moving, you know, let's say through a cycle in a program, like, maybe one, you're choosing the core work you're doing based on the need of the athlete per se, but, like, things like anti, you know, lateral flexion, anti-extension, anti-rotation, like, how are you kind of cycling through those in terms of how you train the core with your guys? Are you doing, you know, most of them all together in a given cycle? Like, are you changing them based on what the need is, or kind of based on what you've worked on previously? Like, what's your thought process there?
Well, it's a little bit of, I mean, it's a depends question, right?
For sure.
Questions are, but the big five patterns, the fifth pattern is actually spinal stability in that single leg pattern. So the spinal stability piece is the core isn't just, too many people think that the core is the abs, right? Your six pack. That's not what the core is. The core is the corset that surrounds your entire spine. So with those big five patterns, the core iso series, we worry about isometric strength on the front, sides, and back. So it's an iso ab. It's a plank on the front side. We call it front iso ab, a side iso ab, and then a hip raise on the back side, which is, you know, involving, you know, motor control of the pelvis, the glutes, and then the erectors on the back side. So they'll go through those patterns increasing time. Usually we start them at 20 seconds and build up to 60 seconds. And then we'll drop that back down and start to increase intensity. So then we start at, you know, 20 or 30 seconds again with added weight and build back up to 60 seconds. So that's our basic fundamental, you know, pattern for spinal stability. Then we'll start progressing those guys into other movements like the Palaf press, because now they can control their pelvis. They know how to kick in their glutes and they have motor control. So we'll start including things like the Palaf press. When we're in high periods of rotation, which is fall ball during the season, we don't throw med balls. We don't rotate a ton. We do more anti-rotation, more stability work. We want to stabilize. Too many athletes don't know how to stabilize. They're rotating, you know, 400 or 500 times a day over at the field. And we have to remember that all that skill that they're doing, it's stress. It's adaptation energy that we have to accommodate for. So we don't want to overdo it on the side of rotation, especially with our younger athletes. And I harp on this a lot in everything that I talk about. Pars fractures run rampant in baseball. And you guys honestly might not see them as much as we do in the South, but in the South, these kids, there's no off season. They play all the time.
Yep. Yeah.
So pars fractures, which is just a stress fracture for the listener. It's a stress fracture in the lower back, usually L1 through L5, from repeated extension and rotation, right? They have no core control. They have no pelvic control. They don't have, you know, they don't have strength throughout those movements. They might lack mobility, whether it's hip, thoracic spine. They're compensating somewhere. Their body will always compensate. They might have a poor pattern on the mound where they want to push off quad dominant, and then they have to generate rotation through some other means, which a lot of times is the lumbar spine. And so the body will always find a way to compensate. So that's why we hammer so much stability for the spine with our core program. It's all stability based. And then when we have that stabilized, I guess, so to speak, then we will start working around more rotational stuff, as in med ball throws. We'll do some of that rotational work.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great point too, just to kind of hammer home, like we said before, like when you're in season or when you're, you know, in a point of a lot of throwing and rotating, whether even if you're just a position player and you're obviously throwing and taking a lot of swings as well, like you don't want to do too much of that in the training world. You almost want to oppose it, like you said. So that's a great point.
Yeah, it's all stability work for us. We actually went through a time when we did, you know, opposite sided. So we'd say, well, let's do, you know, 3 sets of 10 opposite sided throws just to offset what we were doing over at the field with swings and this and that. And then I started thinking about it and looking, you know, we'd count swings over there and you'd have kids that took 200, 300, 400 swings in a day. And you're like, is 3 sets of 10 on a med ball throw?
Yeah, it's not going to. Yeah.
Am I really opposing this? There's a better way. And so that's why we just said, we're just going to make sure that these guys are super strong and stable.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a great point. Okay. So like the last thing I wanted to kind of get to, with you, and I've talked about this with several guests in the last few episodes, but like, I like to get everyone's kind of take on it. So we just spent an entire episode talking about, you know, the importance of the foundation with the movement patterns and all that kind of stuff. But taking a leap forward, so to speak, and we're going to go into a little bit more complex stuff for like the last 5 minutes or so. So the importance of producing force in the context of your sport, right? You know, going to kind of give you this phrase and you can kind of take it and run with it. But thinking like the, you know, world's best squatters and biggest squatters aren't the fastest sprinters. What does that mean to you?
Right. Well, what it means is that they don't have time to apply the force, right? You can have the most force. You can apply the most force in a slow mean, and it has no transfer to athletics. So I think you had, wasn't it Max you had on a few weeks ago, Schmarzo?
Yes.
And so I love what he said.
I've been using it over and over again. I loved it too.
He says it better than I do. And I don't remember exactly what he said.
He mentioned it in the basically like the way I said, the context of your sport. I jacked that from him. Basically saying you can never be too strong in 0.8 or 0.9 seconds or something like that.
Right. When you talk about sports skill, it's all in context, right? There is no such thing as too strong, but it has to be in relation to the context of the sports skill, which, you know, which is where we end up for us, we have three basic programs. We've got our developmental program, our foundation program. I'm sorry, for our developmental athletes, our intermediate and our advanced. And once guys for us are strong enough in the squat happens over the course of 1 or 2 seconds, right? We're not applying force fast there in a max effort lift. So once they're strong enough and they have a base level of strength, we need to learn to apply that force faster somehow. You look at sprinters. Sprinters apply force in 0.08 to 0.12 seconds. Yep. That they have on the ground. That's a blink of an eye. That's, you don't get that from squatting 600 or 700 pounds, right? There's a lot of ways to skin the cat, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to apply force fast to you know, be a better athlete, I guess, essentially. But there are limits when you start talking about the weight room, but there's no limit to force if you can apply it in that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, the way he said it, really resonated with me in terms of explaining it. And people, I put a video up, a post a month or two ago. And I just labeled it strong enough because it seems to be, you know, what everyone likes to use, thinking conceptually of that idea. And I like to say, you know, and Max again really brought up a great point here, is we all have performance indicators, you know, with our training, like things we're testing. So, you know, one, see progress, but two, kind of see the effectiveness of our programs, right? You know, people ask like, oh, is there a, you know, a threshold per se, or, you know, is there a number on the squat or the trap bar or whatever it is? And I'm like, no, but you should have an idea of where you are and engage, you know, if you're at that point, just based on the feedback you're getting. And like, let's just say we're using the vertical jump as our main lower body power, you know, metric. If, you know, an athlete went from 300 on their front squat to 350 and that barely went up, then we might have to take a step back and say, okay, like, what, you know, are we doing? And do we have to kind of change our thought process? And like you said, you know, working more towards moving loads in a little bit faster of a manner.
Right. Exactly. And something else for the listeners that they need to understand about having too much strength. It's not necessarily that, you know, strength isn't bad. It's not having too much strength all the time. It's how much time it takes to add on to that strength. It's the adaptation energy that it takes for one of your athletes to go from a 400 pound back squat or a 500 pound trap bar deadlift max to a 520 pound max. It might take 3, 4, 5 months of training to get that 20 pounds, but at the end of the day, that 20 pounds doesn't matter. It's too much effort. It's too draining on the nervous system. It's too much adaptation energy for the body with too little return. We're not getting any return in the end. So that's really where the too much strength comes into play, is it really giving us a return on our investment? Is it worth that time and energy? Or could we be using that time and energy spent somewhere else way more wisely?
Exactly. Yeah. And I also saw on the opposite side of things, and like, I like to just kind of like take things I see on Twitter and bring them to the podcast for like kind of my take on them and my guest as well. People also maybe get caught up on the opposite side of the spectrum of like trying to move really light loads too fast right away. And there isn't that base of force. So like, you don't want to go down that road either, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that's why I don't use velocity-based training until my athletes have strength, to be honest, until they've advanced into the intermediate program at worst. And usually we use it a lot more with our advanced athletes than even our intermediates. But you have to have strength to be able to produce force. Mass is part of that equation. So yeah, I made the mistake early on when I was an intern in a GA. You know, we used to have – I'd have soccer females using velocity-based training with little to no weight, right? They could squat 120 pounds as a max, and I'd have them putting 60 pounds on a bar trying to do velocity-based training, which when you look back, I'm like, well, they had no – they couldn't produce force. They weren't strong enough, right? So movement comes first in our book, and then one of the ways to advance that – is to start using accelerometers and to put velocity based training to use.
Exactly. Like I said, you know, make sure you have that that base of force first and then kind of go from there. And that's kind of the king of everything, right? Like letting the level of force dictate what you're doing and making that decision.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and one of the ways that we used velocity based. I know you like to talk about VBT, so I was just going to touch on this.
Yeah, no, I was going to actually ask you if you had any last thoughts you want to leave the listener with. So take that away for your parting thoughts here. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, one of the ways we use velocity based training is to auto regulate the training load during the in-season period. It's excellent for that because we have no idea a lot of times where our guys are as far as their, you know, stress levels and how they're feeling. And so velocity-based training really allows us to auto-regulate their training program in season. It allows us to maintain and actually gain strength without using heavy loads for our stronger guys. It's an excellent means for that. But really, it's built around where they are for the day and how they feel. And we can use a load that is representative of you know, kind of where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's a great point as well. Like if you're a coach, you don't really know this till you've seen it, but like taking kids, taking college guys, taking pros, whoever it is through in season and seeing, you know, the ability to maintain, not only maintain, but also build on, you know, what they did in the off season by maybe keeping the loads, you know, a little bit on the sub max side of things. But if the intent and the speed is there, like you can really make some strides.
Yeah. I will say right now that the biggest weakness we see at the high school level across the board is that kids will train their tail off in the off season and completely dump lifting and training in the in season, right? Oh, I'm too busy and I don't have time.
Yes, yep.
Too many games. The only reason you're training in the off season is so that you're the best baseball player possible in the in season. So it's two steps up the mountain and three steps right back down to start over again. So we cannot let athletes, we can't let athletes do that, right? They need to know the importance of training in the in season, right? To maintain and gain. You can gain easily in the in season with while you're playing. It's consistency drives results. And if you are consistent with your training off season and in season, you will be shocked at the results that you get.
Yeah, absolutely. Just if there's one thing to kind of drive home at the end of the episode for the young listeners is like, make sure you're taking care of your training and can, you know, maintaining your consistency in season, or else, you know, like you said, it's, you know, another step back in the process of like the work you just laid, into the foundation, you know, through the entire off season. So well said on that end.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Yeah. Two steps up the mountain, three steps back down.
I like it. So, I mean, I know I kind of just let you kind of hit on the VBT there, but I always like to give my guests, you know, the end of the show if they wanted to kind of, you know, leave the listener with a parting thought on anything we talked about. If, you know, if there's nothing, then it's great. We got a lot covered, but I always like to give that opportunity. So if there's anything, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, we can. So, you know, I would impart that biomechanical efficiency is honestly the most important aspect of baseball. It's the ability to move and control your body, right? And that's across the board, whether it's in your sporting skill or whether it's in the weight room. You see increased force outputs with better movement, and you see decreased stress at the joint level, right? So think of it as a pitcher. There's a reason why a 160-pound pitcher can throw 95 or 98 mile an hour when a 240-pound pitcher that, you know, vertical jumps 36 inches and front squats 400 pounds might throw 85 mile an hour. It comes down to biomechanical efficiency and the ability to move and control your body, right? In baseball, the kinetic sequence is everything. So the better you are as a mover, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's really well said on that end too, like making sure the power, the force, the, you know, all of that stuff that you have the ability to produce is, you know, being allowed to produce, being basically allowed to produce in the most efficient manner. And that's what's going to, you know, make you that, you know, elite guy in terms of velocity or swinging power or whatever sport you're playing. So well said on that end. I want to thank you for coming on. I think that was awesome. I'm really excited to get this out. I think the listeners are going to have a lot to kind of take away from it. And, I'm labeling it, you know, the synergy between quality movement, you know, strength and speed. And I think that, what we talked about beautifully hits on that, you know, in terms of we can build the foundation and obviously, you know, progress it and ramp up the intensity, but it's just all a process.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're doing. Your podcast has been phenomenal. I listen to it every week when I mow my yard, if you can believe that. So,
that means a lot to me. So I really appreciate it.
Keep up the good work. And, I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it again. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DiFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.